This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this annual edition of the program, U.S. foreign and national security priorities for the Biden administration in 2023. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. From Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine to China's increasingly authoritarian rule, the United States and its allies face another challenging year. Analysts say that democracy is under threat, not only from autocracies like Russia, Iran, and China, but also from within democratic countries like the United States, Italy, and Israel, where extreme right-wing political factions wield considerable influence. As we enter 2023, U.S. President Joe Biden does not have so-called unified government as he did in his first 2 years in office. From 2020 to 2022, Democrats controlled the White House, House of Representatives, and the Senate, albeit with a razor-thin majority, requiring Vice President Kamala Harris to break tie votes. In the new 118th Congress beginning this month, Republicans won a narrow 222 to 213 majority in the House of Representatives, but they did not capture the Senate, which remains in the hands of the Democrats, who gained an extra seat, giving them a 51-49 edge. Even though the executive branch has significant leverage in crafting foreign and national security policy, Congress holds the purse strings and conducts oversight. Under a unified Democratic Congress, the Biden administration did not face serious opposition to its efforts to provide robust financial support to Ukraine, but that policy has come under criticism from many House Republicans who assert they will oppose providing a, quote, blank check to Kyiv. Many Republicans have also criticized the administration's immigration policies, which can be construed as a national security issue. On the other hand, despite opening on Tuesday, January 3rd, the 118th Congress did not start off on promising footing. The first order of congressional business is to elect a Speaker of the House. However, it was the first time in 100 years that neither a Republican nor Democrat won the House speakership on the first round of voting to become leader of the 435-member chamber. A group of staunch conservative Republicans voted several times against Representative Kevin McCarthy, who for years has sought to lead the chamber with a Republican majority. On this edition of the program, we will talk with our Georgetown professors about the major foreign policy challenges facing the Biden administration and constraints that a divided Congress, a Republican House, and Democratic Senate may place on the administration as it pursues its 2023 foreign policy agenda. Anthony Clark Arend is professor of government and foreign service and chair of the Department of Government at Georgetown University. Previously, he served as Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Graduate Affairs at the School of Foreign Service and Director of the Master of Science in Foreign Service Program at Georgetown University, and Mark Lagon. He is a distinguished senior scholar in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He is also Chief Foreign Policy Officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. That's a Washington-based nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the goals of the Global Fund. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here.
Great to join you again.
First, let me start off with Anthony Clark Arend. Tony, we call you, if you don't mind. So, Tony, we have divided government. We have a Democratic Senate, a Republican-led House. What message do you think the chaotic beginning of the 118th Congress sends to our allies and adversaries about either the strength or weakness of our democracy?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think on the one hand, the election of Joe Biden and the fact that we didn't have divided government in the first 2 years of his administration sent a very strong positive message to our allies. Given that the Republicans have gained the House, I think a lot of our allies are concerned about whether our commitment to NATO will stay as strong as it has been, whether our commitment to Ukraine will stay as strong as it has been. However, you mentioned the challenges in electing a new speaker. This perhaps signals to our allies that the Republican Party is not quite as strong as they may have thought themselves to be. And as a consequence, I actually think that's a good message to our allies. The Democrats have demonstrated strength in the House. They've also increased their numbers in the Senate, as you mentioned. And so, frankly, the little chaos that we saw trying to elect a speaker might actually signal to our allies that maybe things aren't going to be as bad or as tumultuous or as different as they thought it might be.
Mark Lagon, how do you see that?
Well, I think the context leading up to the last election was the world looking at Joe Biden trying to return to the table of cooperation with the world after the particularly insular and sharp-elbowed Trump administration. And if you were an ally of the United States or a partner in the global South, you might ask yourself, well, if it's easier to work with the Biden administration and they're showing leadership, will the Trump situation return? And so a Republican House at least creates this partial worry that a withdrawal ethic or a perniciously unilateral policy would come about. I share Tony's view, however. I think the greatest danger to U.S. foreign policy in the world is that the House Republicans block funding bills or block the lifting of the debt ceiling so that the United States can continue to fund foreign assistance and to fund its defense programs. The fact that there has been chaos in the early part of this Congress and the House doesn't show that the House Republicans are likely to show great unity. And as for Congress, it may well be that the Senate Republicans are more important. They don't hold a majority, but they have a different character. And I think you're going to see some areas of bipartisan agreement, that China is a serious problem, that Russia is a spoiler and has had a remarkably inhumane policy in Ukraine, and also on global health, as we've faced 3 years of a pandemic and lessons to draw for future global health security. There are signs that that bipartisanship may remain solid.
Turning back to you, Tony Arend, so we will get more into the role of Congress vis-a-vis funding or blocking funding. But let me ask you a straightforward question. As we enter now 2023, what, in your view, are the most pressing foreign and national security challenges that we face?
Well, I think there's several fold, and you alluded to a number of them in your introduction. I would say the most pressing acute issue remains Russia's action in Ukraine. I think that continues to threaten the global order. You have a permanent member of the Security Council using force in clear violation of the United Nations Charter. You have great, sad evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity being committed by this permanent member of the Security Council. You have Ukraine struggling for its independence and autonomy, struggling to maintain itself as a state in the international system. So I think that is the most pressing, acute issue. We did see the international community come together. We saw NATO, we saw our European allies, we saw a number of other allies come together. And that was a very strong message. But that remains our most acute challenge and something that could go on for months or even years. The second challenge, which is in a sense more of a longer term challenge, but is nonetheless in some respects more of an existential challenge to the United States and the United States' role in the international system, is China. You mentioned the increased authoritarianism under Xi Jinping's regime. That is something which has challenged human dignity, has challenged human rights. We've seen China making these exorbitant, I would argue, illegal claims to the South China Sea, its efforts to create the Belt and Road Initiative to try to make gains in the global South. And I think in the long term, China's threat, its desire to be a competitor and to indeed outpace the United States really remains the longer term challenge to the United States. But then I would also add here, thematic issues such as climate change, something that needs to be addressed and is still not currently being addressed properly. That is a huge, I guess, fundamental existential challenge. And then another one I would mention, which Ambassador Lagon also noted, and that is the challenge to global health. We are still in the midst of a pandemic. And frankly, now that China has moved away from its zero COVID policy and seemingly taken a let's everybody get COVID policy, I'm very worried about what that will mean for the next phases of COVID and other future pandemics as well. So I would see those as the most serious challenges, with Russia as sort of the most acute, China as a longer-term challenge, and then, of course, global climate change and global pandemic challenges.
Turning to you, Ambassador Mark Lagon, for your take.
Tony points out the hot problem countries and broad issues of the day. Let me answer in a different way. and somewhat more optimistically. Over the last 3 years, we have seen problems that the United States and countries around the world have faced on a backsliding of democracy and a resurgence of the influence of populism and authoritarianism around the world. And then the world has faced health security threats, in large measure COVID-19. We saw trends in the last year where the United States was offering more collaborative and compassionate leadership, and some of the worst trends started having a good turn, or that the worst effects were being beaten back. On the democracy, human rights, and just basic dignity front, the world rallying around Ukraine is as striking as the inhumanity of the war crimes that Russia has been committing. That President Zelensky has inspired his own citizens and the world is a sign of a trend in the right direction. When Mahsa Amini was detained for having a loose headscarf, hijab, and died in detainment, there have been huge protests, and the protests have persisted even with the killing of protesters or execution of their leaders. And in China, despite the incredibly tight grip of the Communist Party leadership, it had to deal with protests about its zero COVID policy and changed its policy. So that brings up the second area of global health. And I think the Biden administration's offered leadership, working with the G20, Indonesia, Norway, to try and create a pandemic fund at the World Bank. But perhaps the best sign of things is the thing that I work on day to day at Friends of the Global Fight, which is the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. The Biden administration increased the pledge of the United States by 28-30%. Countries followed suit. Japan, Canada, Germany, the European Commission increased their pledges to the Global Fund, not just to finish the job in fighting AIDS, TB, and malaria, but for investing in health systems and fighting the pandemics of the future. And countries of the Global South, Rwanda, South Africa, Uganda, increasing their pledges as much as the United States and the big donors. Kenya increasing its pledge by 67%. Those are promising. And bilateral programs in the United States like PEPFAR reinforce them. And so these are the challenges: democracy and authoritarianism in a dangerous trend, and global health security, which is a human rights issue and a security issue, but some signs of possible progress.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Georgetown University professors Anthony Clark Arend. He's professor of government and foreign service and chair of the Department of Government at Georgetown University, and Ambassador Mark Lagon. He's chief policy officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. And we are discussing the main foreign and national security challenges facing the Biden administration in 2023. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Here's a shout out to a Facebook fan, Sorab Amanzai from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our discussion. So over to you, Tony Arend. I wanted to go around the world a little bit, even though you both outlined the big challenges, both acute and longer term. What about Latin America and the election of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva? To what extent do you think his leadership, particularly with regard to the Amazon, that that's a positive sign? And what about U.S.-Latin American relations? Should that receive greater attention from the Biden administration?
So I think Lula's election is certainly much better than Bolsonaro staying in power. So I think that was a good development. Whether he will be able to take some action on the Amazon, I think, remains to be seen. I will say this. I feel as though the United States has not had a good Latin American policy in decades. I know when Kennedy was president, he talked about the Alliance for Progress, and there were efforts to do that. But I feel as though the United States has generally had a policy of neglect in some cases, benign neglect in some cases, and intervention which generally proved to be disastrous in other cases. One of the challenges we have right now are citizens from South America and elsewhere in Central America who have moved through Mexico and gone to the U.S. border, and we're not adequately addressing the issue. And in large respects, it's because the issue lies not at the border per se, but lies in the states in South America and elsewhere. And I don't think we've had a coherent policy, and I haven't really seen efforts in the Biden administration to develop a coherent policy. And I think this lack of coherency has really been something that goes at least back to the Kennedy administration. And frankly, you can go back before that and see problems in the Eisenhower administration, in the Roosevelt administration, and back to the previous Roosevelt administration. So I think that is something we've neglected, I think in part because the problems don't present themselves in as acute a format as, say, something like the invasion of Ukraine does. Moreover, at least during the Cold War, there was an awareness because Latin American states were being used by both sides as pawns. Well, that's not really happening, although China maybe is trying to make some inroads. And so it's just very easy to neglect Latin America. So I'm not sure what the Biden administration is planning to do. But if I were to give advice, I would say there needs to be serious leadership there. And it would be very easy for the president at least to begin making some overtures toward developing a better policy.
Not least because, Mark Lagon, of the border issue. And we know that particularly the House of Representatives, the Republican majority, is going to call the administration to task over that, even suggesting that they might impeach the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. So we have also an example of a good trend, a democracy. The election of Lula da Silva. Many think that he will do a better job with regard to climate change over the Amazon. What is your take on U.S.-Latin American relations in 2023?
Well, I agree with much of what Tony said. Two things come to mind. One is the United States, since the Cold War, has not had a coherent policy, has not been a coherent dance partner. Professor Aaron and I highly admire the older President Bush, the 41st President of the United States, and his Secretary of State, James Baker. But James Baker said that with the end of the Cold War, Central America would return to the back pages of the New York Times where it belongs. Well, that led to neglect after that period in which the Soviet Union and Cuba on the one side of the United States on the other had their client relationships in the region. You know, there are serious problems of deadly violence and corruption in Central America and some parts to the south that are drivers of the migration problem. Looking for safety and economic opportunity. I hate to use the expression root causes, but the United States needs to think about root causes. Lula's election is promising. There is sort of an irony because the Trump administration has criticized the leadership of Venezuela, but the Trump administration exhibited some of its qualities, which was to speak up for the common man and yet enrich elites and new cronies. It has been a Latin American pattern of having such vicious fights between parties that their actual legitimacy has been called into question, and there's been a criminalizing of politics. Well, the Trump administration brought us to a kind of high fever of that same kind of behavior in the United States. And that's the danger that one sees in the House. Impeaching a Secretary of Homeland Security or wasting the taxpayers' money on endless discussions of the imperfect, perhaps shady behavior of the president's son are not the best focus for coherent policy in Latin America or elsewhere.
Some critics are saying, too, politicizing the border, and nobody's saying that this is a good policy, but this will be a very important flashpoint probably for 2023. I would like now to turn very briefly to the Middle East. First to Israel. Tony Arendt, are you concerned about the ultra-nationalist Israeli cabinet that we have now and the minister who visited a flashpoint Jerusalem holy site for the first time? And I'm talking about Itamar Ben-Gvir. How concerned are you and how worrisome will this relationship be, that is Israeli-United States relationship and potential for solving once and for all the Palestinian issue and the two-state matter? How worried are you that this is going to be a major impediment and actually cause a great deal of concern and heartache and maybe heartburn for for the Biden administration?
Well, I think the main concern I would have about Israel is a possible strike against Iran. I think that has been a concern. And now that the government has moved further toward the right, that would be something that under certain circumstances could present itself. That would be my biggest concern. I think the United States is going to continue to maintain a strong relationship with Israel. I feel as though the Biden administration will be critical, mostly behind closed doors. But my biggest concern would honestly be some kind of action against Iran that could then lead to further complicating of matters.
And turning to you, Mark Lagon, I'd like to get your take on the very right-wing government we see in Israel and to what extent that could cause problems for the administration, as well as what Tony said about a potential strike on Iran from Israel. And again, Iran is very hardline. They're revisiting the killing of the top Iranian general just 3 years ago this month by a U.S. drone strike under the Trump administration. They want revenge for that. They're having a great deal of problem with women-led protests. Their very existence is under threat, no question about it.
In Iran, I think we're in a much better position with people expressing themselves and fighting for their rights openly in Iran. It demonstrates that the grip of the regime is not as full. Of course, there's a danger that it might try and use aggressive action internationally to bolster its legitimacy at home. But I think we're in a much better situation where the Biden administration is placing the United States at the negotiation table about restoring the framework agreement on their nuclear program. And as far as Israel goes, and Israel possibly making a preemptive strike, you need to look at two factors. One is that, unfortunately, alternatives to a Likud-led coalition have not succeeded in governing well, whether it was the corruption of Olmert as prime minister, the really unfortunate passing of Ariel Sharon, because that was the closest we got to a two-state solution, is when a true hardliner formed a new party and might have been able to steer that, hence walks in the Likud with its ultra-right party partners. I think we're better off with the quiet admonitions from the Biden administration than a really striking policy under the Trump administration of a green light for anything to the then Netanyahu government of Israel, that it could legally take full sovereign control over territories that it occupied for a long while, and moving to the United States, having the embassy in Jerusalem, which was a friction-causing event, not only with some of the Arab states, but the world.
Well, gentlemen, as we close, let me ask you both any final thoughts you have, particularly now that we have divided government, and to what extent can the Republican-led House stymie any of Biden's priorities vis-a-vis Ukraine, combating Russia, et cetera? To you, Tony.
Well, first of all, and Mark mentioned this earlier, there is hope for bipartisanship. And frankly, the debacle concerning the Speaker of the House may be a signal that people can pick up on more bipartisan stuff. But I would also note that there have been a number of people doing bipartisan things. Much of it has not been getting a lot of public attention. And I would point to someone in the Senate, as Senator John Ossoff from Georgia. He has been co-sponsoring a whole lot of bipartisan bills, bills connected to the military. I know he has a great interest in foreign policy. I know he has a great interest in war powers related issues. So he's one possibility I see is doing more, especially that the Democrats have gained an additional seat in the Senate. Now, in the House, Mike Gallagher is a congressperson from Wisconsin. He's former military himself. He has a PhD from Georgetown. And he is also somebody who apparently, depending on how things go in the House, is going to be heading up a select committee on China. I think Gallagher's instincts are bipartisan. So I see there as being hope for movement in that direction.
I see opportunities as well as challenges. I agree with Tony, the United States needs to work on its own political system and be an exemplar. But I commend President Biden for not feeling like you have to sort everything out in a troubled democracy at home in order to work with other nations in a vigorous way to fight for human rights and democracy around the world. I want to take an analogy from climate change. There are island nations around the world that are in danger of being submerged because of climate change under the oceans. Well, there are islands of bipartisanship on particular issues like dealing with China, fighting human trafficking, fighting AIDS. And the danger is that the roiling seas of U.S. polarization in its political system will submerge those islands of bipartisanship rather than those being examples to expand bipartisanship. I have hope, though, that the American political system, for all of its failings, can learn lessons. There is hope for those islands of bipartisanship to stand, even with the circus-like situation of the House leadership.
On that note, gentlemen, that's all the time we have on this 2023 Foreign Policy Agenda program. I'd like to thank my guests, Professor of Government and Foreign Service at Georgetown University, Anthony Arend, and Mark Lagon, Chief Policy Officer at the Friends of the Global Fight Against AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Gentlemen, thanks again for your terrific insights and analysis.
Pleasure to be with you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.